meeting minutes from March 4th, 2013? Representative Carlson moves the meeting minutes from March 4th, 2013. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Those are adopted. Ms. Brower. So this is a, thanks for coming down, or back. So this is a continuation of what we started on at the last meeting on some of the demographic changes. And I don't know, does this, so this has everything that was in before the PowerPoint. Okay, so we're starting at which?
So this is, I believe, slide 15.
Okay. All right, go ahead. Yes.
Yep. Okay, so when I last presented to this committee last month, I showed you how our population projections allowed us to anticipate what we could expect in terms of population aging in the next couple of decades. We saw how aging will likely impact general fund spending through increased enrollments in elderly medical assistance, particularly in the area of long-term care. And we also saw that a majority of baby boomers are currently not prepared to cover their future long-term care costs. With respect to this long-term care spending, I just wanted you to be aware that DHS is working on an effort to help educate Minnesotans about long-term care. It's called Own Your Future. And it's a federal and state effort to increase public awareness about the need to have a plan for long-term care, including how to pay for it, as you're aware. When I last presented, I also showed you how population aging will slow labor force growth going forward as more baby boomers leave the workforce and are replaced by a smaller cohort of younger workers. And we've seen how population aging will likely put a premium on high-skilled workers. Under the new demographic normal, it becomes more important that all of our young people are prepared to step into the jobs that will support a strong economy, meaning those jobs that require post-secondary education. These are the sector of jobs that have helped us emerge from the recession more quickly than other places around the country, and they're the jobs that will likely help keep our economy growing in the absence of rapid labor force growth. I believe that these aging pressures also raise the urgency of addressing the educational achievement gap. Over the next 20 years, we project that the fastest growing populations in Minnesota will be our Asian, African American, or Black, and Latino populations. And we've all seen what the academic achievement and attainment gaps look like by race. The gap in educational attainment and employment in Minnesota is among the worst in the nation. And here we see that the rates of dropout are very high among two of our fastest growing groups in Minnesota. 1 in 5 Latino students have dropped out of high school 6 years after they began, and more than 1 in 10 African American students. Asian students, the other fastest growing group, they're better in this regard, but there's considerable variation within that group. And oftentimes when we look at differences in high school graduation rates or in educational attainment by race, the picture gets kind of muddied by the fact that we have a fairly sizable immigrant community. So do some of the racial differences that we see exist because we have large populations with language and other barriers that suppress the on-time graduation rates that we were just looking at? Well, our office looks specifically just at those young people who were born here in Minnesota and found that these gaps still remain, even among our Minnesota-born children and young people. Our future labor force will not only be growing more slowly than what we've been accustomed to in the past, but it will also become increasingly diverse. As those baby boomers age out of the prime working years, the young group moving into the workforce to replace them, as I said, is smaller, but it's also more diverse. It has a higher share of people of color. This diversity is built into our age structure and will continue into the foreseeable future. So just to give you a sense of what the future workforce will look like in terms of diversity, I have these working age population highlighted here on the slides. So viewed through these projections, differences in education by race increasingly signal an economic problem, a productivity problem that could threaten Minnesota's future economic growth and the revenue side of our state budgets. So to recap, going forward, there will likely be pressures to shift resources from younger residents to older residents, but we need to rely increasingly on skilled, highly productive labor force to realize economic gains and to continue to pay for public services. In this context, consistently poor outcomes among our fastest growing populations could become a threat to the well-being of Minnesotans, young and old. In closing, I've been asked to share with you how our water resources in the state and around the U.S. are likely to impact demographic and economic landscapes going forward. I'm certainly not a water expert, but I do know that there are some important relationships between demographic and economic growth and our water resources over the long run. And these are relationships that experts are increasingly paying attention to. So up until very recently in Minnesota, we've not had to think much about water scarcity, at least not to the same extent that other states have had to do. Water is still relatively inexpensive, and there have been few signs to the average Minnesotan that it could ever become scarce or costly up to this point. It just so happens that the areas of the country that are growing the fastest are also those that have issues with water, water scarcity in particular, in the Southwest, sort of fastest growing region. And as the supply of water becomes increasingly an issue, the price of water can be expected to rise going forward. This map is showing the current groundwater storage relative to the historical trend stretching back to the mid-century, last century. It depicts drought associated with climactic variability as opposed to the depletion of aquifers. There are several aquifers in the U.S. that have been depleted over the past century, the southern half of the High Plains region, for example, but particularly in the southwest portion of the U.S. Since many areas of the country price water at a very low rate, even those areas where water supply is currently in question, the rising price of water will likely influence a wide range of decisions impacting site location and economic development going forward. Laurent August, who is the CEO of Voila Water Americas, said that industries and businesses should understand that water will become one of the critical elements responsible for ensuring the reliability of their operations. Put simply, if you don't have reliable access to water, you cannot run any business. And if you're unsure about the reliability of your access to water, then you've got a challenge in terms of making an investment. Water will ultimately impact the decision-making processes of investors and companies as they decide where to locate facilities. Chronic water shortages may force large changes in migration patterns and job locations, resulting in massive shifts in demographic and economic growth across the country. Water resources will likely become an economic concern in the future. And as I said, I'm not an expert in water resources, but I am aware that this is an issue that demographers are watching across the country because they know long-term that it will impact how we grow across the nation. So these are the short-term, the mid-term, and the long-run changes that are ahead of Minnesota with respect to demographics. We will feel the effects of population aging very quickly. Our increasingly diverse populations that are now in our schools and moving into our workforce is more of a midterm trend, but the trend in diversity will continue into the foreseeable future. Long-term planning for workforce and for water resources will pay dividends for our economic competitiveness for decades to come. And while many of the trends that I've presented today and last time we met are sobering, we'll never be in a better position to address those changes than we are today.
So any questions, members? Okay, thank you so much. Oh, Representative Marquardt.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair and Ms. Brower. I think on pages 8 through 10, the information you just presented there is so compelling. When you look at our population of the future and also those groups that we have the greatest disparity in educational achievement, and quite frankly, when you look at on page 10 where we talk about work growth almost coming to a halt, which means any new folks coming into that work have to be more productive. And that's going to be huge for economic competitiveness. And when you look at our overall economy into the future, the number one strategy I see here is closing the achievement gap. When you really look at that, and I guess I'd like to have your comment on that.
Ms. Bauer.
Members. When I look at the demographic trends in terms of aging, in terms of which population groups are increasing most rapidly, that's an area of concern that I see as well. And so that's why I chose to highlight it. So.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I mean, when we talk about a lot of things, Mr. Chair, on making sure we have economic vitality into the future, I mean, just looking at the demographics here, I think is so stark and so compelling that if we don't deal with the achievement gap, that's going to have huge implications into the future on our economy. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks. Thank you very much. So now we're going to move on to some of the federal fund stuff. Margaret Kelly, first of all, if you could come up from MMB and talk to us a little bit about the federal fund summary. And then we'll talk a little bit about sequestration as well. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I've asked Bill Marks and Eric Naumann to just join me at the table now so that we can answer any questions you have as we go forward. Again, Margaret Kelly, State Budget Director with Minnesota Management and Budget. And I'm going to start by giving you an overview of federal funds in Minnesota's budget. Federal spending in the state of Minnesota impacts this state through direct payments to individuals or organizations, through grants to local units of government, to state government, to nonprofit organizations, in the form of procurement, direct procurement on the part of the federal government, and wages of federal employees that are here in Minnesota. Not all federal grants are distributed through the state. There are federal grants that go directly to local units of government or to nonprofit organizations. And so while much of federal funding does flow through the state budget, not all of it does. And so you will see some discrepancies in numbers as we talk, and it's due to that in part. So an example is Head Start. Head Start grants go directly to those entities.
And just on that note, we're not going to take any public testimony on this subject, but we did invite people to submit kind of on the effect of federal funds or sequestration, and there is in your packet at least one from Head Start on the impact that they're going to have on their, that the sequestration at least is going to have on their budget. So go ahead, I'm sorry.
Sure, that's fine. So some federal funds that come through the state are not retained by the state. Some are retained by the state. They're for activities that the federal government would like the state to do on their behalf, or activities they would encourage states to partake in. Some federal funds are passed through directly to other units of government or to nonprofit organizations. Title I in special education is an example of pass-through funds. They come to the state, and we send them directly to school districts. The Community Development Block Grant is an example where there are some federal funds that go directly to the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, and other federal funds come to the state, and we disperse them through our Department of Employment and Economic Development. The four largest federal grants that come to the state are medical assistance for our MA program, our highway planning and construction. Much of our highway funding is happens in participation with the federal government. Cash and food assistance through the Department of Human Services, and education funding through our Department of Education. Okay, so overall, Minnesota ranks 49th in states in per capita federal expenditures. And so this is an even larger picture of the impact that sequestration could or would have on Minnesota and other states. And so much of federal spending occurs in the area of defense spending and federal employees, and we do not have much of that here in Minnesota. And so when you see on the far right of this screen, the light blue is Minnesota, the darker blue is our U.S., we are much below the national average when it comes to procurement and salaries. This direct payments is the form of Social Security and Medicare payments to individuals, and we're a little bit below the national average there. Where we are more competitive, but not at the national average, is when it comes to grants, so dollars that come to organizations and governments here in Minnesota. So while there will be significant impacts, as the Head Start letter probably addresses, it may be more severe on an economic perspective, and that's what Dr. Stinson often talks about, that sequestration at a national level will have impacts that ripple through the economy, and we'll see it in terms of economic growth and jobs in Minnesota and other states. So in our budget itself, federal funds in the Minnesota budget, approximately 30% of our 14-15 budget is federal funds, $9.7 billion in fiscal year 14 alone. And the vast majority of that is our Medicaid match, the federal's share of the Medicaid program, MA program, almost $5 billion of the $10 billion. Another $1.1 billion alone in grants within the Department of Human Services, almost $1 billion in education funding that flows through the Department of Education to school districts, almost $1 billion of funding that flows through the Department of Transportation for roads, for highway construction, and then another $2 billion of grants in all other areas of state government in departments like Employment and Economic Development, Department of Health, Military Affairs. Approximately 10% of the state workforce is funded through federal grants. This pie chart shows you just how much. This is a 14-15 budget. Shows you where the federal funds are spent in the Minnesota budget. So you can see there, clearly half of the funds are in our Medicaid program, and that is not subject to sequestration. And this is a biennial total compared to the previous slide, which was just 1 year. So the next biggest slice of the pie is in the Department of Human Services, grants and activities in that department. After that is education, the next biggest slice of the pie, and that primarily goes to local school districts. After that is transportation for highway construction. Deed, Commerce, Health, Military Affairs are the next big agencies that receive federal funds. And then all other state agencies are about $1 billion over the next biennium in federal funds. Sure. You have received this packet here. It's about a 100-page document. We pulled out of every budget, every agency's budget, their federal funds summary. And so included in the biennial budget, in each agency's budget, is a summary of the federal grants that they receive in their budget and what they do with that and how much it is and what they anticipate that amount to be. And so it will indicate whether a grant is a pass-through grant or retained by the agency for specific activities. And I'm not going to walk through this, but you have it in your packet if you want additional information.
Chair?
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you. This is really useful, but I think it's also important to know that while the pie chart tells us sort of the biggest dollar numbers, in terms of the impacts on actual services, last night in Health and Human Services Finance, we heard that, for example, the health department, 60% of their budget is federal funds. So even though it looks like a tiny slice of the pie here, the impact on that particular agency and its ability to respond to outbreaks and other issues is really severely impacted, perhaps more than some of even the larger agencies.
Sure.
Representative Senator Sendrum, I'm sorry.
Thank you. I wonder if you can just maybe go to page 5 and just help me get grounded a little bit. And I'll just try to make my question somewhat simple. We say 9.7. Let's just say $10 billion of our money comes from the federal government in 2014. And just in round numbers, my recollection is we have a $60 billion biennial budget divided by 2, so $30 billion, I'm sorry. So is it to say that about $10 billion out of $30 billion comes from the federal government?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. About
just
a third.
Generally?
Just under a third.
Okay,
yep.
Thank you.
Okay, well, whoever, are we switching now to? Oh, Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the issue of the total amount of money that we get from the federal government, is there some way you can quantify for me or explain to me what Minnesota's share of the cut caused by sequestration will be? In other words, you say we get $10 billion a year from the federal government. If I recall correctly, the sequestered amount at the federal level is like $85 billion out of a total of so many trillion. I don't know what it is. So what's our share of the cut caused by sequestration?
Mr. Chair, that's a perfect segue to the next section here on sequestration.
Sorry about
well
that.
Well done.
Great minds think alike. I'm going to just start and give some general overview and turn it over to Bill and Eric to talk about specifics that they've put together. So how will we fare with this sequestration? There are a lot of unknowns that remain. While decisions have been made at the federal level, the implementation and the impact of those decisions are slow to trickle down to the state in terms of tangible information. Some agencies have moved more quickly than other agencies. Some federal agencies are trying to mitigate the impact. So we will talk through all of that. There are some restrictions that are being placed on state agencies in terms of how they can manage reductions. Some state agencies are waiting to hear more. The final amount of reductions are still unknown yet. But from a big picture, we expect a potential in the $90 million area. So if you recall, fiscal year 14, $10 billion in federal funds, we expect the reduction to be about $90 million. And that's based on estimates from the Federal Funds Information for States, FFIS, and Bill and Eric will talk more about that. But there are increases in the federal budget that may offset some of these reductions, automatic increases, COLAs in specific programs, or specified increases at the federal level that may mitigate some of these reductions as we move forward. So this is just a picture.
Representative Carlson had a question.
Can I ask a question? when you talk about the timing of reductions, your first bullet point there, it's my understanding that just this month, now this would be dealing with federal employment, but it would have an impact on unemployment insurance and so on, I'm sure. Notices of furloughs just went out under federal law for April. Do we have any idea of what that means to the employment figures in Minnesota and what the impact might be on people who would be entitled then to unemployment insurance?
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, that's a really good question. I don't think I have the answer in terms of how many of those federal employees that have been furloughed are here in Minnesota. I'd have to go back and talk with Dr.
Mr. Marks.
Mr. Chair and Representative Carlson, the other point there with the furloughs that the federal government is talking about, those are probably people that aren't going to show up in the unemployment statistics because they're working one less day every 2 weeks or something like that. They're not going to be in unemployed as such. They will be making less money, which will affect tax revenues and so on, but I don't think they will show up in unemployment information.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's
Representative Carlson.
What I understand that each of those agencies has some latitude as to how they're going to handle that. And so you're saying that they'll probably just simply reduce the number of work days or hours in most instances?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, to the extent that people's employees' work hours are getting reduced, there will be some laid off, too, I'm sure, or some contracts not continued, and those may affect unemployment statistics, but the furloughs as such, as to the extent they are working less time but still employed, would not affect the employment statistics.
And if I may, Mr. Chairman, going back another area on page 5, being that we're moving back, that you indicated $2 billion in grant funds across the rest of state government. And one that came to mind that relative to the big picture may not be major, but would be higher education and Pell Grants and the way the state formula works, where, need is determined after they determine what the Pell Grant will be, and then basically the state grant backfills. And do we have any idea of what that might mean in terms of the state obligation with the state grant program? Because in the past, that's gone up and down depending on federal funding in terms of what the impact is on the state grant side. And members, that can very quickly become tens of millions of dollars, which is what we've learned in the past.
Mr. Chair and Representative Carlson, I am not sure the extent to which the federal grant, Pell Grant, is covered or exempt from sequestration. So that's a grant that does not come to Minnesota at all. It's a grant that goes to individuals, and I will have to look to see if it is covered by the sequestration or exempt from the sequestration. And Office of Higher Education could probably assist us.
Maybe we can get more information on that.
It's Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding that the Pell Grants are exempt, but I'm not 100% sure.
Find out. Ms. Kelly.
Sure. So going back to this high-level overview, not every federal item of expenditure is covered by sequestration. So this is a list of the 10 biggest grant programs at the federal level and the extent to which they are covered or exempt from sequestration. So on this list of the big 10, you can see that education, one of the largest grants at the federal level, is subject to sequestration, and so that will impact school districts, both Title I and special education funding. After that, it's Head Start, one of the larger federal grants that is subject to sequestration, and that will impact our programs across the state. And the WIC program, one of the 10 largest, is subject to sequestration. That's in the Department of Health's budget, and that is subject and will be impacted as we move forward.
Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this goes back a little bit. Do we have any numbers for Minnesotans directly employed by federal funds that are subject to sequestration? One that I can think of is some of the aviation employees in the towers. Certainly the numbers in front of us today are those within the state budget or pass-through. But do we have any handle outside of the state budget in direct federal programs and their impacts in the state?
Ms. Kelly.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holder, that's a really good question, and I'm not sure if we do. I will need to go back and talk with our economists to see what data is out there, unless either of you know.
Yeah, we'll follow up and get some information.
So what are we doing here at the state level in response to sequestration? We are tracking updates from FFIS, and Bill and Eric will speak to that. We at MMB are communicating with their federal cognizant agency, their federal funding agency, to better understand exactly what is going to happen in the area of sequestration. MMB and state agencies are meeting periodically and in communication to track the information that agencies are getting and the impact to their grants. So we've only received guidance as a state. We've only received guidance from federal agencies on about a third of the funds that we believe are subject to sequestration. The guidance ranges from this is the dollar impact to we're trying to mitigate it, hold on, we'll get back to you sometime in July or September, to we think it will be more than you've been anticipating, to we think it will be less than what you've been anticipating. So the guidance so far is kind of all over the board, nothing consistent.
some information that is useful to agencies. So I think the Department of Employment and Economic Development and the Department of Health have gotten more information than other agencies to better understand impacts of some of their programs. But again, it's not all of their funding. Some agencies are expecting to hear more in July or September when the actual federal grant awards come down so that they then at that point in time will know what the impact is.
Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Kelly, has the administration articulated a position or a standard for agencies? In other words, have they said if there's reserves, go ahead and use them to backfill? If there's not legislative constraints on the money? I know there's been some discussions in the transportation area about maybe using MAC money to pay for air traffic controllers. What has the governor done to manage this issue on a state level to provide guidance as to what the parameters are for individuals under budgets under his jurisdiction, if you will, to provide guidance?
As we currently stand, Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, as it currently stands, the while the governor expresses concern over the impacts that there's going to be with sequestration in agency budgets, his budget as it stands today does not backfill. But that does not mean he's not encouraging agencies to look at what they can do internally to manage. Some of the sequestration cuts come with very specific parameters. And I don't want to say I know exactly what it is, but within the WIC program, whether or not they can change the level of the grant versus the number of enrollees is specified by the federal government. Within military affairs, reductions there, the state is not able to fill behind. So each grant, I think, comes with its own criteria. Agencies are working to better understand that and to see what they can do about it, if anything.
Representative Holbert.
Well, Mr. Chair, Ms. Kelly, will there be like a formal sign-off process if somebody's wanting to track reactions or adjustments to the implications of this? How will they find out? I mean, there's a lot of opportunities in some way areas to move people around or move money around. How would, in your statement, you said that the governor's told his agencies to manage as best as possible. Will there be some kind of sign-off process if we're using reserves or moving money around within agencies to mitigate these impacts?
Ms. Kelly.
Ms. Chair, Representative Holbert, that's a good question. I don't think we know enough about agencies taking actions yet in response to sequestration to answer that question.
Well, Mr. Chair, then I'm reading between the lines here, but it sounds like that there hasn't been any formal policy statement from the governor to the agencies of you can or can't do this or let us know. So could we maybe surmise that in some instances agencies are already making accommodations that may not have been signed off by the governor?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, I think what I'm saying is that agencies are not yet at the point of knowing enough to make accommodations, that we have not reached that point of having to have any sign-off. And what the formal process will be, I can't speak to that yet.
So we can, we can certainly come back in this group in July. It sounds like we'll have more information, or maybe even earlier, and follow up on those questions as well.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think it's probably the time to get some answers sooner than July. I mean, I would like to know what latitude they're going to have. If they're going to have a lot of latitude to move money around or use reserves in the course of establishing a budget for the next biennium, those would be some important things to know now, not in July after everybody's left and we wouldn't have the ability to react to any of the impacts. And I'm not sure that no decisions have been made. I think there have been some decisions, particularly in the area of the air traffic control and whether we close Anoka or Crystal and whether MAC money is being used or not. I mean, those discussions are going on now, and I'm just curious what type of tracking and oversight is implemented or not in the governor's office and the executive branch to keep track of all this. It doesn't sound like there's been a formal process implemented to order priorities and decide that which is most important. I think the realities of the federal budget is that some of these cuts are going to be structural and not one time, and the decision on whether or not to backfill them, somebody should have a handle on the state's purse strings relative to this process, and I'm not sure I'm hearing that at this point.
Ms. Kelly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbrook, that is a fair question. I don't want to suggest in any way that there are reserves within agencies to manage, and I think one of the challenges of sequestration is that these federal funds come to do priorities that are federal priorities, and then the question is, when the federal government backs away from those priorities, do we then make them a priority of the state? And do they compete with state dollars that we have decided are priorities of the state? And I think that those questions are still being wrestled with within agencies, and we will get back to all of you on the formal process for making those decisions. But there aren't reserves within state agencies to simply access and tap into. Most agencies, their dollars are all allocated as you all have specified in appropriation bills. So,
and Mr. Chair, I mean, I think that would be important. I mean, it's one very basic thing that could be determined from a very high level would be if a federally funded state employee, that 10% of the workforce, if the funding for that position goes away, what is the policy? Is that person then terminated as a matter of administrative policy, or are they going to try and find another place for them in the agency in a state-funded program? I mean, I think time is short to try and put some structure around how this will be handled at the state level.
And so, Mr. Chair, before I turn this over to Mr. Marks to go through the presentation that we've put together, I wanted to circle back to Representative Carlson's question. Senator Pappas's memory is indeed correct. Pell Grants are exempt, and there is a key factor in all these programs. First, the law that enabled sequestration in the original instance specified certain programs that would be exempt and non-exempt, and then it splits them 50% on the federal on the defense side and 50% on the discretionary side. OMB has allowed some specific interpretation authority for various programs, which is why I think Mr. Marks is going to speak to some of the variability and some of the lack of information that we have. But we do know that the 2011 Budget Control Act at the federal level did specifically exempt the Pell Grant program. So I think that that's the information to your question.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's good, because my initial question was, because our grant program is somewhat on automatic pilot with the backfilling, so I was, if that was subject, I was curious what the impact would be. And apparently not then, so that's
Mr.
good
Chair,
news.
Representative Carlson, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I will say that some of the quick research I did while we were sitting here says that it's exempt for 2013, which seemed to imply that maybe it's an open question for future years, but I'll leave it there.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Marks.
Mr. Chair, members, you have in your packets a memo from Mr. Nauman and myself with some information attached to it. This is information that we have received from the Federal Funds Information Service, or FFIS, as Ms. Kelly has already referred to them. And it's not complete information by any means. It's limited information. FFIS says this covers about 70% of total federal funding. That's 70% of total federal funding at the federal level, not necessarily 70% of the federal funding that Minnesota receives. They have provided estimates for specific grant programs, and the numbers on the attached chart are showing there are sets of numbers there The first number is the fiscal 2012 appropriation, federal fiscal year 2012 appropriation. The second year says fiscal 2013 final. That was the final number before sequestration. The third number is post-sequestration. And then there are two comparison numbers, a dollar change and a percent change. I should just note all those numbers are in thousands, so add three zeros to it. The chart lists the federal grants by federal agency and then the program within that agency. It also includes what's called the CFDA, or the Catalog of Federal Domestic Assistance number, which is a number that's used to find these grants or to track these grants. The numbers that are showing the changes between fiscal 2012 and fiscal 2013 post-sequester are not only affected by sequester. They're affected by other changes that were made at the federal level. And the most federal programs were continued for back in September were continued for 6 months on a continuing resolution. That continuing resolution provided slight increases in many programs between fiscal 12 and fiscal 13. Then the programs a couple weeks ago when Congress passed a budget again, many programs were continued for the next 6 months under a continuing resolution that continued them at the level they were at for the first 6 months. And then that, in conjunction with that continuing resolution, the sequester was also modified for some programs, but not for many, or not for a lot of programs. So the sequester had been in place prior to that. And I think maybe a good example, since we've talked about Head Start a little bit, would be to go to page 2, and the page number 2, it's actually the third page in the set, but the fourth from the bottom is Head Start, under the Health and Human Services Head Start area. And you can see the numbers there. It's showing the Head Start for the Head Start programs in Minnesota for fiscal 12 received $84 million. That was to increase to $84.406 million for fiscal 13. And then post-sequester is at $80,178,000. Then the final two numbers compare fiscal 12 to fiscal 13 after sequester. It's a reduction of $3.875 million or 4.6%. If the comparison were being made fiscal 13 post-sequester to fiscal 13 before sequester, it would be a reduction of $4.228 million or 5%, and 5% is the sequester number in many programs. Need to add, we've also found out that this is only part of the Head Start money coming into Minnesota. In some discussions with Head Start folks, they believe that it's about $102 million, or it had been about $102 million. Apparently, part of the Head Start money is under another grant number and is not included in this particular list. So, need to caution that this list is incomplete. The programs listed on these pages are those that we have information for from FFIS, but it's an incomplete picture. It will give you an idea for a number of programs what they are. The notes after the program, and for Head Start, it says that the final. The fiscal 2013 post-sequester column is calculated using OMB's final sequester percentage of 5% for non-defense discretionary programs, or 5.1 if it was a defense or non-defense mandatory program. So that's where the 5% cut comes from. So that's the information that's here. Again, it's I need to emphasize it's incomplete. It doesn't provide all or doesn't list all the programs. It's the ones that we have received information from FFIS at this point. We know it's incomplete. It's at this point it appears to be the best that we can do. In reference to what Ms. Kelly presented, I need to mention that this is information that's presented to us by. People working at the federal level, they're not working within the state, so there could also be contradictions in perceptions. Then I want to mention that at the end, in the middle of the last page, I did total the numbers. FFIS also provided us totals for the numbers for all the programs here. You can see that these are only adding up to $6.8 million of the $9 million that Ms. Kelly talked about. These would show For these particular programs, this shows a $170 million reduction between fiscal 12 and fiscal 13 post-sequester. I don't have the calculation there, but if we were going fiscal 13 pre-sequester to fiscal 13 post-sequester, it's a reduction of $53.4 million. So the point would be there are a lot of things going on in these numbers besides sequester, or in addition to just sequester, it's other changes. And another example would be if you looked above on that last page at the transportation programs, you can see on the first one at the top of the page a substantial increase in the National Highway Performance Program. But if you look at the last one in transportation, the equity bonus program is eliminated. So there are other changes besides sequester going on within these numbers. So I know it's not a very satisfactory picture in the sense of trying to look at everything. It's what we have at this point.
Senator Bach had a question.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Marks, on the bottom of page 2, the bottom two programs say this program is exempt from sequester under the Act, but we're still showing a reduction. But the reduction wasn't a result of sequester. It was just a budgetary reduction. So that, but you're counting it. I mean, there's a lot of ways to calculate this, but it's a little confusing.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bach, that's correct. These reductions did not result as a result of sequester.
Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's my understanding, and maybe, Mr. Marks, you can talk a little more about the effects of this on Medicare. It's my understanding that starting April 1st that the hospitals received a 2% cut, and I guess I don't know if that's included in these numbers. Maybe you can talk about the impacts of sequestration on the Medicare.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dowd, I'm not familiar with that one. I don't know if Ms. Kelly can add anything here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dowd, all I would add is that Medicare funds do not flow through the state, so those payments, that within the context of the sequestration, there was also a 2% reduction to Medicare providers. So not Medicare recipients, but Medicare providers. And I'm sure that's what that is speaking to.
Representative Holbrook.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Marks, you used a comment that I've never heard you use before. You're pretty good about the numbers and the reality, and you referenced a contradiction in perceptions. Can you expound on that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Holbrook, I think what I was referring to is these numbers are provided to us by people who are working at the federal level, working at this from a federal perspective. We're looking at it from a state level and from the recipient of these kinds of programs. And then we're also dealing with people like the Head Start, or people who work in the Head Start programs, as an example, or the hospitals who are on the receiving end of these things, and they're all looking at these differently. And I think in some cases sequester is getting the credit or the blame for what's some things that are happening in other parts of the funding program, or in other that were part of other funding decisions, as Senator Bach already highlighted. And then the other thing I just want to emphasize again is this is an incomplete picture. The programs that Representative Dowd raised or questioned on the bottom of page 2, these are Medicaid administration, Medicaid vendor payments. There may be other parts of Medicaid that aren't being listed here. So I think all of this is presenting an incomplete picture, which can lead to those kind of contradictions.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Holbrook, it's also worth noting, we said it at the beginning but didn't focus on it, these are federal fiscal years, which of course begins in October, which our fiscal year is different. So if you were to translate them even into our numbers and the way we think about them, we would need to make some adjustments to get them into state fiscal years.
Mr. Chair, I just generally, when our fiscal staff presents to us, they don't use terms like contradictions in perceptions. They usually tend to stay more in the actual numbers, or choosing different numbers or impacts, or including or not including various things. So I think it just reflects how confusing all of this is, and hard to sort out. I appreciate the work that you've done.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, and I think it's indicative that we don't have very complete information here, and we're not necessarily real comfortable presenting it because we need to keep emphasizing that this is incomplete. This is a partial picture. We don't know all of the information. We don't know. We're not presenting a complete picture at this point because we don't have more information.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Kelly, you didn't talk too much about this. I think you provided this, right? Could you just explain what the purpose is, what this tells us?
Certainly. This is a, Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, this is a, each, there are, this is a summary, a compilation of the federal fund summary that is currently in each agency's budget, the document that MMB produced with the governor's budget. And so we have pulled out of each agency's document the federal fund summary and just simply compiled it here for your review. So within the context of, if you were to turn to the very first agency in here, the Department of Agriculture, this is simply a list of all of the federal grants that the Department of Agriculture receives. It provides their CFDA number, whether or not it's a new grant that they're receiving or a grant that they've received before, what the purpose of the grant is, who the recipients of the grant are, and what the dollar funding is. And if there's a requirement, a match requirement, or a maintenance of effort requirement at the state level.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Kelly, so there's nothing in here explaining the impact from sequestration. That was in the shorter page.
Mr. Chair and Senator, to some extent, some agencies did identify what the impact of sequestration would be if they knew anything at the time. At the time we put the document together, there was not a lot of information available, and many agencies said that we're just waiting to hear more.
Mr. Chairman, just one more. So what are the columns that say 2014 and 2015 base? What do those represent?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, so that represents the anticipated level of funding that agencies will have in their base budget for fiscal years 14 and 15 from these federal grants. So it referencing the comment that Mr. Nauman made, turning a federal grant award into a state fiscal year. So, for example, you can see on this very first grant item, the non-point source implementation, that in fiscal year 12, they received $62,000. In fiscal year 13, they received $62,000. And they anticipate in fiscal year 14 that they will have only $7,000 and no funding in fiscal year 15.
Mr. Chairman, so what you're saying is the $7,000 just represents the difference between fiscal years?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, no, the $7,000 represents how much grant funds from this particular grant they will have available to them in fiscal year 14.
Okay.
My guess is that this was a one-time grant that was over several years, and they spent $62,000 in 12, $62,000 in 13, and they have $7,000 left to spend in 14. Okay. That's my guess.
Thank you.
Senator Carlson, or Representative Carlson.
Just a question. It kind of goes back to the dialogue we had earlier about Pell Grants, and at least through this year. Reminds me then of a broader question, though. If this is the new normal because of the federal deadlock, programs, for example, on page 9 that are listed as exempt today, are those programs permanently exempt? I'm just not sure how the federal law operates relative to the future when we talk about sequestration.
Mr. Chair and Representative Carlson, we'll see when I'll start.
That's fine.
Sequestration is a one-time event, and so it applies to federal fiscal year 13, and in federal fiscal year 14, they have, what is it called, their budget limits. And so sequestration is a one-time event at the federal level. And then going forward after this federal fiscal year in sequestration, they will simply make the adjustments within the context of the budget.
And so the sequestration was automatic across the board. Every line item of the budget took a hit. But moving forward, they will make decisions about where to apply the lower levels of spending.
So just to, Mr. Nauman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Carlson, I'll just add one additional comment to that, that when the sequestration authority was essentially conceived back in, I think it was 1985, it set up a system within the construct of the federal government where certain programs were specifically exempted and other programs were, and that the Office of Management and Budget was given interpretation authority to interpret, based on a broad array of criteria, other programs that would be exempt from sequestration should it ever occur. Then you lay on top of that the Budget Control Act of 2011, which further exempted certain programs, or did not in some cases. And so those, part of the speculative nature of Mr. Marks's document is that you have to lay on top of it the original authority, combine that with the subsequent Budget Act, and interpretation, ongoing interpretations that the Office of Management and Budget at the federal level are making about these programs, which leads even further to the speculative nature of all of this.
Okay, thank you.
So, Ms. Kelly, then what you said basically, but the base is lowered because of to the amount of sequestration, mm-hmm. essentially in 14 and 15 going forward for each agency, the overall base,
Mr. Chair,
they pass a new budget.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if it's lower to the level of sequestration or not, but the anticipation is that federal spending is lowered in future years.
Yeah.
Something along the lines of sequestration.
Okay. And Mr. Chairman, the point of my question was then those, as it rolls forward, that are exempt remain exempt.
Mr. Chair.
And when you said it was one time, that was my interpretation of what you were saying.
Mr. Chair, going back, and Representative Carlton, going back to what Mr. Nauman said, programs may be exempt to sequestration in the future, but just because they were exempt from sequestration this year does not mean that they will be exempt from federal budget cuts in the future.
Yeah, no, I understand that would be a separate budget debate. Yeah, thank you.
Any further questions? All right, thank you. And we're adjourned. Thank you.